It's not easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it might be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that. It's not easy being green. Seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things. And people tend to pass you over because you're not standing out like flashy sparkles in the water or stars in the sky. But green's the color of spring, and green can be cool and friendly like. And green can be big like a mountain, or important like a river, or tall like a tree. When green is all there is to be, it could make you wonder why. But why wonder? Why wonder? I'm green, and it'll do fine. It's beautiful, and I think it's what I want to be.
When children listen to Kermit the Frog sing "It's Not Easy Being Green," what lesson, if any, do they absorb? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Did young children learn empathy or racial tolerance from watching educational TV, or is that just wishful thinking on the part of adults? Can LGBTQ teens use TV programs as a successful way to come out to their parents? Can apps help those with substance abuse disorders or dementia? My guest, Marie-Louise Morris, is a professor of communications arts at the UW-Madison who has studied the impact of media on us throughout our lifetime. Today, we explore families in a media age. Welcome to University of the Air, Louise. I'm always interested in what makes someone study what they do. And I'm curious, in your case, what led you to studying how the media play a role on us in different points of our life?
Sure. Yeah, I've always, to be honest, a lot of my research, though not all of it, is based on seeing my kids or my friends' kids or kind of life events that really trigger an aha or a question in my head. And the bigger question I've always had is kind of there's media content and then there's how we interpret it in our heads. And so I've been sort of fascinated about that potential gap.
Well, one question I have for you, too, is, you know, you were born in Czechoslovakia, raised in Australia, then coming to Wisconsin. Do you think your sort of global background plays any role in your interest in different interpretations of what we're watching?
Oh, that's a lovely question. I don't know. I mean, I certainly had a sense of being something of an outsider when I grew up in Australia. My parents were Czech and had thick accents, and we read lots of books in a small village where that wasn't a really popular activity. And I studied journalism, actually, in college, but then came to Madison and studied here and realized, oh, my God, I'm just fascinated by these questions of stories and how we tell stories and how as we age we interpret those stories differently or we're attracted to different sorts of stories.
I have to tell you that one of the papers you wrote, which I read, you know, to get ready for today's interview, has already changed me. It's called Be Kind to Three-Legged Dogs: Children's Literal Interpretations of TV's Moral Lessons. The paper, you know, you looked at, I think it was 64 kindergartners, and looked at an episode of Clifford, the big red dog, one of the PBS kids' so-called educational programs. And it changed how I see children watching any kind of educational program. Can you talk about what happens in that episode and what your study revealed?
Sure, yeah. Well, let me say, I first came across this episode. I would let my kids watch TV for half an hour before dinner while I would make dinner. And I had one half eye on my kid, and he was watching this episode of Clifford the Big Red Dog. And I could see that basically Clifford and Cleo the pretty dog and T-Bone the kind of sidekick dog, they meet a three-legged dog. It comes out from behind a fence.
Let's listen to that part.
Hello there. What was that? Hi, my name's KC.
KC? I didn't know a dog lived here.
Oh, we're just here on vacation. Hiya, KC. I'm T-Bone, and this is Cleo. We're on our way to meet Clifford. Who's Clifford?
He's our friend. He's great.
Would you like to meet him? Sure, I'll come out. He sounds nice.
Oh, my gosh.
He's only got three legs. What are you guys going to do today?
Huh? Well, we may go to the beach.
Really? I've never been to the beach. What do you do there? We run around.
But we don't have to. Run, that is.
Oh, running's fun. What else?
There you guys are.
Clifford!
Wow. You're the biggest dog I've ever seen.
Yep, I'm pretty big, all right. Who are you?
My name's KC. Cleo and T-Bone invited me to play with you guys at the beach.
Great.
Well, I've never been to a beach.
Oh, you're gonna love it. We run and jump around and chase stuff.
Oh, great. I'll go get my ball.
What a nice guy.
He's only got three legs, Clifford.
Oh, my gosh.
What should we do, Clifford? He wants to play with us.
So, let's play.
I don't know.
We just have to remember that KC probably can't do most of the stuff we can do, so we have to look out for him.
So then the way the story continues is that clearly the people writing the story wanted, in effect, to say to kids, if you see someone with a disability, it's natural that you may be afraid, but you don't need to be. You know, you're not going to catch germs. It's all going to be okay. And you also don't need to go out of your way to be extraordinarily helpful. They'll be fine. They just want to be friends with you. And that's kind of the main thing that the episode is supposed to teach. Like, you can just be friends and they just, like, it'll be nice. And you don't need to be afraid. And when I watched that, like, across my kid's shoulder, I kind of thought, well, two things are going on here. One is we've got a metaphor, right? This is about a three-legged dog and these other dogs interacting. And the idea that that translates into a kid you would actually meet, I was not convinced my kid was going to get that. And then so much of the episode was focused on the being frightened or doing the wrong thing part, and actually very little was focused on the happy resolution. It was like the last minute where they finally kind of get it.
Well, and before we get to the last minute, yeah, you mentioned about the worry over germs, and there's this whole part where Cleo is afraid she will pick up leg-losing germs and somehow end up being a three-legged dog herself. Let's listen to a little of that.
You can slow down if you want to. I don't really want to catch up.
Why not?
I don't know. It's just, what if he's got a disease or something? And he wants to play tag.
Huh?
What if he's got some kind of leg-losing disease that he got from some terrible germ, and when he touches us, we get the germ and catch the leg-losing disease and... Oh. And then we all lose our legs.
I don't think that could happen, Cleo.
Do you?
I don't know, but I think we better be careful.
Yeah, so then it's only after that that they kind of go to the beach, then eventually, you know, Casey makes these little jokes, you know, like, oh, where's I'm missing a leg? Where is it? Oh, I must have left it on the ferry. And that in itself is actually somewhat confusing to kids. And then finally, they kind of have this heart-to-heart where he says, I just want to be friends. And they kind of climb up on Clifford and go up the elevator. And it's a happy ending. But the happy ending, you know, has a lot of talking. And I wasn't convinced kids were going to get it.
But I was wondering how long it would take before somebody mentioned my leg. After all, you've been staring at it all day. Sorry. It's okay. It's okay. I'm used to it. I know it probably looks strange to you, but I'm still a dog, and I like to do the same things any dog does.
I know. You can catch a ball better than I can.
Well, I can do most things the same as everyone else. I really like doing things for myself.
Sorry, Casey. I know that. Now.
But I do need help sometimes. When I do, Clifford, you're definitely the guy I'm gonna ask. Deal? Deal.
So how do you design a study? I mean, you're watching your own child watch this and you're kind of wondering about it. So let's say you want to go from that to actually doing something with scientific validity that will help us understand what a typical kindergartner would gain or not gain from an episode like that. How do you set up a study?
Well, you know, often it takes more than one study, and often my first study isn't the greatest. But here was my initial study with exactly that episode. So I went to the Madison Metropolitan School District, and I recruited these kindergartners, and we went to the school and we interviewed them one on one. These 64 kindergartners. And basically we said, can we show you a clip on our laptop? And we showed them one of two versions, and they were randomly assigned as to which version they were going to get. So we created the original version, or we had a version where we edited out like the extended part of the fear where Cleo is worried about leg losing germs and just put in kind of a chunk of another episode where they're just hanging out at the beach. And then we asked them like a series of questions, and every kid got asked the same question. And I have to say, it was funny when we were interviewing these kids. You know, like, I remember one kindergartner, he sounded like an old man. He was like, well, I used to watch Clifford when I was a baby, you know, yeah. And like it was like he was going to humor me by letting me ask these questions that were going to be so easy. But he also got confused, you know, by what was actually going on in the show, even though to him it seemed as though it was going to be really easy. And so we would ask things like, you know, sometimes people who make stories have something they want you to learn. Like, do you think this story has something, you know, they want you to learn? And they'd go, aha. Uh-huh. And we go, oh, great. You know, what is it? And then they would sometimes be like, I don't know. Or they would say, and they would just give a kind of a general moral principle. And sometimes the kids who had heard the kind of seen the version with all the fear stuff in were like, well, you have to watch out for germs, or you got to be careful, you know. And actually, they seemed to be taking away the wrong thing.
Like the opposite of what was intended.
Yeah, the opposite, exactly. And then we actually showed them, because kids vary in how verbal they are, particularly with a stranger, we gave them three choices, and we showed them kind of a photograph. So one photograph was just of an adult kind of talking to kids, and we gave kind of a general moral lesson, like, you know, if you do something wrong, you should always tell the truth, even if you'll get into trouble. And, you know, and is that the lesson? Or if you see a three-legged dog or a cat or another animal, you should be nice to it. And we showed a photo of a three-legged dog. Or if you meet a kid with a disability, like they have to use crutches, you can still be friends with them. And we showed a photograph of a girl getting off a school bus with crutches. And what we found was that like over 80% of the kids chose that the lesson was being nice to a three-legged dog.
So very literal.
Yeah, very literal. And that's not surprising. I mean, like, you have to kind of learn that, oh, this is a metaphor and I'm supposed to take this story and apply it to life, but it's not an application about dogs and cats. It's supposed to be this larger lesson about humans. There is no human appearing in that episode with a disability to help kids make that connection.
Now, would the same be true of reading a book, not having the visual element, you know, of a TV program, but let's say you read something like The Boy Who Cried Wolf. And the lesson is obviously that if you lie, you're going to erode trust. And then when you need help, people won't trust you. But would you say the same kinds of conclusions would happen, that the same children might originally conclude, well, watch out for wolves or something about sheep, but not necessarily take away the trust lesson? Or is it easier to get the lesson from being read to because you have a parent or other adult right there doing the interpretation and talking to you about it?
Yeah, that's a great, like, whole set of questions. Well, we know, not only from my research, that actually kids take a while to, even from reading stories and having adults read them stories, this ability to extract a larger theme from a story is something that develops, and it develops, like, well through 8-year-olds, 9, 10. You know, it's not something that comes easily because you have to be able to follow the plot, make inferences about why people do stuff, and then kind of think about, like, oh, here's this kind of overarching theme, right? And so even with books, that's difficult. But screens make it more complicated because kids are still learning about what we're supposed to learn from screens and how to interpret the stuff with screens. And as you said, when you're reading a picture book or reading a story, an adult is there and can help. And I really think that kids can absolutely learn from stories, but they need a lot of adult help in doing so.
I have to say, having had three children and now three grandchildren, that I often have found educational TV a real boon. If you are trying to make dinner, do the laundry, or do something else, it feels as if they're watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Daniel Tiger, you know, some of the PBS programming, Clifford, whatever it is, that they're learning, because there are all kinds of lessons about taking turns, about being honest, about respecting people from other cultures or races, learning a different language. All kinds of lessons are contained. And so it was a little shocking when I read your papers to find out that often that was not the case, that sometimes the opposite might be happening. Can you talk about some of the other studies besides the one on the three-legged dog that you did with children and educational media?
Sure, yeah. And let me say, I'm a huge fan of educational media, you know, so it's not like I definitely don't want listeners to go away thinking, like, huh, point is don't watch educational media. I absolutely think that stories and educational content can be really valuable. But I think that kids' understanding is more complicated than we think. For example, I was intrigued by Dora the Explorer and Ni Hao Kai Lan. So in Dora the Explorer, Dora often says words in Spanish, you know, and Ni Hao Kai Lan, she often says words in Chinese. And there are also kind of cultural elements, like, you know, Kai Lan has this episode about Chinese New Year and Dora has one about Three Kings Day. And so the idea is to teach kids a variety of different skills, but also to kind of bring in this kind of cultural element. So when we were doing research with, like, 3 to 5-year-olds, we would show them short clips of these and say, you know, like, I was intrigued by the fact that there's kind of fantasy mixed in, but at the same time, we want kids to learn the actual content there, you know? And what I found was kids are absolutely learning, but they're also making judgments about, like, what's fake or, you know, what's pretend and what's real. So we would say, for example, we'd show them an episode of Dora the Explorer or Ni Hao Kai Lan, and they would learn the words. And when I would say, like, so when Dora says vamanos, you know, what does that mean? And they very often got that right. Or when Kai Lan says Ni Hao, what does that mean? They would say it means hello. So they got it right. But then I would say, so are those real words that real people use in the world? Like, you know, or is that just made up for the show? And what we found was that a lot of the 3-year-olds and even the 4-year-olds and even some of the 5-year-olds were like, well, that's just made up for the show because it's complicated. I mean, Dora isn't just saying vamanos. She also hangs out with talking animals, and she has a talking backpack. And similarly, Kai Lan, not just, you know, hanging out with Ye Ye and saying true things about the world and using real words, but she's also hanging out with kind of flying animals. And so I think we make it complicated for kids to know, like, oh, this is just the fun part, but this I'm actually supposed to learn and believe.
And does it matter that they're animated? In other words, Dora and Kaylan, they're not actual, you know, children. Mm-hmm. They're animated cartoons. Does that influence it?
Well, you know, that's a kind of a huge debate about whether kind of anthropomorphized or animated makes it easier or harder. What we found in another study I did with one of my graduate students was that little kids, if you say to them, like, if you want to learn, like, you know, this other language, or if you want to learn how to be nice to people, which would be better for teaching you? And we would, like, show them these pairs, like an animated human or an animated animal, or a real human versus an animated animal. And the kids thought basically you would learn best from animation as opposed to live, you know, like having a real person on the camera. So because they see so much animation, kind of that's their intuitive sense, like that's where you learn from. We did do a study with Sesame Street where we had humans interacting. The people at Sesame Workshop were incredibly kind to one of my grad students and let him go to New York and work with kids in New York City, where we looked at an episode where a little boy is learning about fiestas. He's, you know, and Guatemala and so on, and that he learns about all the foods and the dances and so on. And so this is kind of live action. But at the same time, there are puppets in there, you know, dancing and doing goofy things and dancing the merengue and so on. And even there, kids were learning, like they were learning, like what a particular food was or what the dances were or what the instruments were. They absolutely remembered, and they even remembered that stuff really well a week later. But at the same time, even though it was live action and even though there were humans sort of talking about this is what you do in a fiesta, when we said we had another researcher come in who, unbeknownst to the kids, was associated with our study, and they were talking, we had this cover story about toys, and then he goes, you know, I have to plan a fiesta. Like, I don't really know. Like, what do you do in a fiesta? And we were interested in whether kids would spontaneously use the stuff that they had learned in the episode before. And a lot of them didn't, even though they actually remembered it when we tested them later. And sometimes that was because they just didn't think it was real. You know, they got it, like they learned it, but they didn't know that it applied to the real world or it could be applied to the real world.
That's interesting. And I'm sure it gets complicated, too, when you start looking at adolescents, teens, and how media can play a role in their life. We're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Clean up, pick up, put away, clean up every day.
I like this recycling thing. Woohoo! Looking good. Oh, here I come.
That's from Daniel Tiger, one of the PBS educational TV programs for children. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Marie-Louise Morris, and we are talking about families in a media age. Does it help if a message comes in a song?
It can. But I think that one of the ways that songs can be really powerful is that parents can use them with their kids as kind of prompts or reminders or spurs to action.
And let's talk about the role of parents or caretakers or guardians in general. If we know from your studies that a child watching a program may take it literally, may actually come up with the opposite interpretation than we assume they will, what kind of role could a parent play that would make a difference here?
Well, at one point I surveyed parents and I just asked them, like, can you think of an example where a TV program or a film or song helped your kid be nicer? And the majority could. About 70% had an example. But what predicted how long they said the kind of positive effect lasted was how much they talked about it with their kid. So those who said that they talked about it at the time or who talked about it afterwards, who explained the lesson, made connections to the kids' own lives. And then particularly it seemed to be that reminders in the moment. And so you gave the example of Daniel Tiger. Various parents mentioned Daniel Tiger and said things like, you know, we were in the grocery store and my kid was having a complete meltdown. They wanted candy. And I could say, when you feel so mad you want to roar, take a deep breath and count to four. And my kid knows that song, and we could kind of use it in the moment. Or the example you have, pick up, clean up, put away, you know, that kind of starting to say, pick up, clean up, and then the kid will sing it. So parents, I think, can absolutely use educational media as kind of tools, but they have to help kids get it and work with it.
What about the question of race and tolerance that's so important to instill in children? I'm thinking of the South Pacific song, you have to be carefully taught to hate, but you also sometimes have to be carefully taught not to hate or judge.
Mm-hmm.
Do any of your studies touch on that with children?
Yeah, I did a number of studies. It kind of related to the Clifford study. I was really intrigued by how many studies have this sort of narrative arc where, you know, two groups initially don't get along and they dislike each other. And then again, there's a positive resolution. And so we did studies with 4 to 6 year olds or even 4 to 7 year olds. And these sorts of stories, I worry about them, and I think adults have to really kind of think carefully and kind of build on them and say, look, yeah, like in this study, you know, the brown bears didn't get along with the panda bears, but, you know, what do we take away from that? And let's kind of think about all the friends you do have from different backgrounds, and that I have friends from these different backgrounds. And so really parents kind of using, if they're going to use stories of this type, really kind of helping kids understand the positive aspects and not just focusing on the negative part of the story.
Well, and with racial depictions, sometimes it can be stylized. It can almost perpetuate a certain concept, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my graduate students, who's black, biracial, has done beautiful work interviewing or surveying, rather, African-American parents about the sorts of depictions that they want their kids to see. And what they really want is their kids to see everyday images that look like them, everyday kids doing everyday things, families, you know, rather than kind of caricature or really kind of ambiguous depictions and kind of fewer of these kind of stereotypes of particular groups doing particular things.
Another kind of judgment that we hope our children learn not to do has to do with sexuality. And I noticed that some of your work, when it turns to teens, looks at the way they use media to get their parents to talk about sexuality. We can hear that in this excerpt from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
So how did you two finally get together after all these years?
Oh, you know, I'd just been crazy about her forever. And then one day I picked up my battered old guitar and I sang her a song.
Oh.
How did it go?
You don't want to hear it.
Yes, I do.
Well, I don't have my guitar here.
Sing the song.
Rosa, 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 Diaz, 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 Rosa, Diaz, Rosa, Diaz, Diaz, Rosa, Rosa, Diaz, Diaz. You are so cool.
Sounds better with a guitar. Oh. Just put that away.
Who was that in the picture?
Just my mom.
Kind of looked like your co-worker, Amy.
She can name your friends. It's not weird.
He had his arm around her, and she was showing off a ring.
Wow, you got a really good look at that picture, huh?
What's going on?
Jake and Amy are engaged.
That's okay.
What?
We understand. Love is complicated.
Wait, why would you be okay with that?
Mehita, when you called his dinner, you were so nervous, we were worried you were going to tell us you were gay.
So you would rather me be some dude's mistress than be in a loving relationship with a woman? Well, Jake and I aren't dating. But guess what? Your worst fears are real. I'm not straight, I'm bisexual. And I don't care what you think about it. Screw this, I'm out of here.
You know, I love that you raised this because I think this kind of flips the thing I've been saying exactly on its head. So up till now, I've been saying, oh, parents need to help their kids. But again, I had a different moment in my life where one of my kids was kind of figuring out their sexual and gender identities. And when I was sharing that with a colleague, they were like, oh, wow, you must really kind of use media to help them understand. And I suddenly had this moment where I was like, oh, no, they've used media to help me, you know, and they're the one who is kind of taking these moments and using them to open a conversation or curating certain things that I should or shouldn't see. And I'm the one that's doing the learning here. For example, I would say, oh, well, should we go see this film that has, you know, a transgender character? And the answer would be no, because that's not a trans actor. And, you know, that's inappropriate. And, it would make me rethink these things. And it certainly, media served as this really useful point of connection and discussion.
Well, let's say you have parents and a teen watching this episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine together. And we'll hear a little bit more from that.
So your mother and I talked about what you told us last night.
We don't need to talk about that right now.
We want you to know we're not upset.
Great. I'm not upset either.
Because no matter what you call yourself, you still like men, so you can still get married and have a child.
I can do those things with either a man or a woman.
Yes, but it will be a man, because this is just a phase.
And then tell me what kinds of things can or should happen in the discussion afterwards, how that then becomes a way of opening a gate for someone. So we'll hear a little bit, and then if you can talk about how that works in a family dynamic.
Woman. Lady. Women. Two women. Holding hands. Friends. Sisters. Oh, business partners. Co-owners of a chocolate shop. Oh, love?
Love. What do women love?
George Clooney!
It's a wedding! They're brides. They're in love. Mom, Dad, I know you don't want to talk about this, but I do. I might get married to a man like you so clearly want, and I might not, because this is not a phase, and I need you to understand that. I'm bisexual.
There's no such thing as being bisexual.
Yes, there is. I know there is because that's who I am. I'm attracted to both men and women. I've known this about myself for a really long time, and I didn't want to tell you because I was afraid you were going to react exactly like you are.
What do you want us to say?
That you accept me for who I am. Wow. Okay, let's go.
Well, Brooklyn 99 was actually an example that came up. So following my own experiences, I surveyed several groups, large groups of teens, LGBTQ teens. And one thing I will say is that often the teen is watching for moments of incidental exposure. Like the parent doesn't necessarily know the kid is LGBTQ. And so I'll say that the comments and reactions that parents make to depictions can be really powerful. That parents who sort of say, yuck, or even just change the channel silently are sending a pretty potent message to kids that I don't like that, I find that unattractive, undesirable, awful, whatever. And that can be deeply hurtful. And conversely, the opposite is true, that if a kid says, I like that, or, hey, you know, there's Rosa, would you watch that with me? The parent who says, sure, and sits down and watches, that sounds kind of like, I'm open to having this conversation with you. And what the teens and then in another study parents also said is that these things can open up really useful discussions about what are you thinking, how sure are you, what sort of questions do you have. But a lot of it really was the teen leading the conversation and the parent not rushing in to render a judgment, but being willing to accept that this is probably a topic that the teen has thought about a whole lot and may definitely still need guidance and questions answered and so on, but that you might want to let the teen take the lead in the conversation.
What are you doing here?
I wanted to say I'm sorry. I reacted poorly last night. This is all new to me.
I know. But it's also not new, you know. I'm still the same person I always was.
But I don't feel I know that person.
Dad.
My fault, not yours. I want you to be able to tell me everything. I can't promise you I'll understand. But I'm trying. I want you to know that I accept you for who you are, and I love you very, very much.
I love you too.
So, have you been on any dates with women yet?
Dad, we didn't talk about my dating life before. We don't need to talk about it now.
Good, good. You're right.
You include in one of your papers some quotes from teens and from parents responding. And one of the teens said, "Sometimes my mother and I will be watching TV and discover there is a lesbian character in the show. She often skips the parts which the lesbian character is in, and it really hurts me, even though I don't say anything."
Yeah, I know. I mean, there were so many quotes from teens that kind of broke my heart and that made me realize how important it is to think carefully about the kind of quiet but really powerful messages we're sending our kids about what we find acceptable or not. And that was a really potent example.
How do you see teen responses, not just on this one topic, but across the board? How are their responses to watching programming in whatever media form we're talking about, but how are the responses different than adults? Let's say you've got a 13-year-old, and we already looked at how a 4, 5, 6-year-old might be interpreting things very differently than we think. But what about teens, 13, 14, 15-year-olds, when they're watching something, are they responding in different ways than we think?
Sometimes. So, for example, I think like a lot of tween sitcoms, I mean, this is even younger, but tween sitcoms, can be funny to an adult or goofy or silly. But I think they can trigger kind of some anxiety about like, how are you supposed to behave in school and what are the cliques and so on. So I think, again, the lesson about having conversations, I think carries through from like 2-year-olds through to getting your 22-year-old still to talk to you about it. How teens are, I think teens are often much more thoughtful and much more reflective than we give them credit for. And I think what can be helpful is kind of not necessarily telling them what's good or bad, but asking them, like, what do you think of that? And often I think it's certainly been the case in my life that I've been kind of shocked and often humbled by how thoughtful my kids have been. And when I interview teens, kind of realizing how how much they care about the world, you know, and want good things, often very politically progressive, not always, right? But that they're actually using stories and media and trying to make sense of the world in a way perhaps more actively than we tend to do as adults.
I remember Professor Joanne Cantor at the UW in a radio show I did quite a long time ago talked about how pretty much every college student she surveyed could point to a scary movie that traumatized mm-hmm. them as a child. You know, and do you find, too, that when we look at violence or things that are very scary, that it has a more lasting effect, whether we're talking about children or teens, than we might think?
Well, let me first say that Joanne was my advisor and continues to be my advisor, so I'm thrilled to have this moment of connection. Yeah, absolutely. I think that media, you know, a lot of it just kind of washes over us, but for all of us, I think we can think both of things that really frightened us, like the sort of work that Joanne did, showing that almost all of us can remember something that was horribly frightening. And again, often it's not necessarily the things that adults anticipate or know will be frightening. You know, it can look or sound kind of scary for a little kid. Even if it's a good character, it'll be scary. I think in the same way, I think many of us, if we pause long enough and reflect, can think of media content that has had a lasting effect on kind of what we know about the world or the kinds of people that we feel more comfortable with because we've kind of encountered them in fictional stories. And so I absolutely think that media can have long-lasting effect, not every depiction, but can really kind of shape the way we think about the world.
We're going to talk about media and adults when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Marie-Louise Morris. We are talking about families in a media age. We've talked about the impact that educational programming can have on young developing minds. We have talked about how teens can use programming to open up discussions with their parents. And now I'd like to turn to some of the other work you've done, which has to do with working with apps to help those that are suffering from substance abuse disorders or from multiple chronic conditions. Can you talk about that?
Sure, I'd love to. I've been really lucky to work with David Gustafson, and he's a professor on campus in industrial engineering, and he has this research center where the focus really has been on the ways to use apps to help people who have some sort of ongoing condition or illness. And when I tie it back to families, one of the apps that we're looking at and working with is helping families where one of the family members has a substance use disorder, like alcohol, and the ways in which an app can help them and a loved one who is really worried and concerned communicate better. Because often as people are sort of going along together and one has the substance use disorder, you can understandably develop really kind of somewhat maladaptive communication patterns. One is kind of angry and frustrated every time the other has the drink, and the drinker is motivated to kind of hide or lie or get angry in return. So apps can actually help with that.
I'm having trouble picturing how that works. Let's say you have a family let's say it's a husband wife, and the husband is drinking again. How does an app play a role?
I know. Doesn't that seem crazy? Mm-hmm. The first time I heard, I was like, "What? That's the thing you're going to do?" But think about it this way: if you have an app on a mobile phone, that is always in your pocket. And for people with substance use disorders, often access to ongoing care comes like once a week, you know, in a meeting with your therapist, if you're lucky. So on the mobile phone, what you can have is, first of all, kind of tools that help you and your partner think about, like, what are my triggers? And it can kind of have these prompts that you work together to figure out, like, what are the triggers? And so you actually talk about that. And then, like, how could we work together to avoid them? And then there can be prompts like, okay, if I do have a craving, what is helpful for me, the partner, to say in the moment? And then you can actually put that into your phone. So let's say I'm the drinker and I was like, Emily, it's Friday and I'm at this party and I really want to drink. And you and I have agreed. And I send you that message on my phone, right? Because my phone is in my pocket. I can send it to you. And you can write back one of the things we agreed upon, like, hey, it's going to be okay. Cravings pass. It'll be over in a minute. Come home and we'll go out for ice cream instead, right? And so it can really kind of, first of all, you can learn from a phone, and it's also this means of more effective communication.
Well, so how is that different than just talking on the phone or texting on the phone? You mean there's sort of preset messages that a professional helps us have ready?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been lucky to work with a psychologist at another university who specializes in family-based kind of therapy around alcohol. And so there's a whole curriculum. Absolutely. It's not that the phone in and of itself somehow magically enables this, right? It's that the phone can be used with pre-existing curriculum and kind of therapeutic strategies and is actually this really powerful tool when you build in this kind of research-based intervention.
In some ways, it's like having a sponsor or a hotline, but it's more personal.
Absolutely. You know, it can, because, look, families are there, but it can be difficult to communicate well. And so having an app on your phone can help you track your behavior, both the partner and the drinker. And again, there's preset stuff on the phone that helps you do that. It can help you find support. Both the drinker can use support from people who've been through it and understand what that's like, and the partner can use support from people who are going through similar things and who know what strategies tend to be more helpful. It can give you resources in the moment. Again, curated resources like, I really want to drink, but here's a game that can help distract me and get me through that. Or I am freaking out about my partner. Here's someone I can talk to. So you can basically curate on a phone. It can be this whole kind of suite of things to help families, and then this tool for communication to communicate better with each other.
In general, do you find that adults, you know, we've been talking about sort of the media over a lifetime, do you find that adults respond to media in different ways than they used to? Are they taking it more seriously? Are they looking for something different?
Somewhat yes. I mean, I think, you know, we start out as little kids and then we go into adolescence and we have this period where we're sort of testing out emotions and willing to kind of tackle even really dark, troubling emotions and media content. And then my theory is that in, you know, middle age, in a way, we get sort of tired. But one thing I know from some of my research is that as we age, meaning matters more, you know, that you have a sense of less time and you don't want to waste time. And so in some of my studies with older adults, one of the things I found is that they care more about whether something's meaningful or not, and they're less willing than younger adults to watch stuff that they just think is kind of goofy or stupid. And that I think is really interesting.
You've also worked with adults that have multiple chronic conditions, you know, where there's a sort of some health components, both mental health, physical health. Can you talk about that?
Sure. That's also with Dave Gustafson and the center here on campus, which is called CHESS, the Center for Health Enhancement System Studies. And again, the idea is that technology and media can provide a kind of a whole suite of resources for people who are going through something tough, and it can provide support and a sense of there are others, so I don't need to feel so alone, who are going through this, and I can help them too, right? It can provide motivation, like kind of remind us, like, why does this matter? It can provide tools for tracking, like, okay, I have to record my blood sugar every day. I'm supposed to be recording my weight or whatever, right? It can be just a way to do that and see your progress over time. And it can provide kind of carefully curated information or tools. And so I think there's tremendous potential for media to kind of help us tackle these really big issues in our lives, whether that's we're like five and we're learning how to share, whether it's, you know, being a teenager figuring out your identity or your political beliefs, or whether it's as, you know, we're aging and our bodies are more challenging and we're trying to figure out how to stay healthy.
My guest has been Marie-Louise Maris, professor of communication arts at the UW-Madison, and we've been talking about families in a media age. Thank you for your insight. So much to think about.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we'll go out on a song that you referred to earlier on, and it's, again, from Daniel Tiger. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
When you feel so mad that you wanna roar, take a deep breath and count to four. I wanted to play with the triangle, but someone picked it first, and that made me mad. Really, really mad. When you feel so mad that you wanna roar, take a deep breath and count to four. One, two, three, four. We can take turns playing the triangle instead.
The house we built got knocked down, and it made us mad. Girl mad, really mad, 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 mad.
When you feel so mad that you wanna roar, take a deep breath and count to four. One, two, three, four.
I can build an even better house instead.
When you feel so mad,